Blessings upon you, beloved listeners, and welcome to the little confessional that is the best of LNL Summer on RN. And in May, I talked to Father Frank Brennan about the virtues and vices of his Catholic Church, and it was just the sort of thing you'd expect from Australia's Jesuitical juggernaut. For some reason, that theme tonight sounds different to me. It sounds as though it's coming from a castrate singing a bit of High Roman Catholic music. And that would be appropriate because my guest sitting opposite me is my favourite Jesuit, the splendid Father Frank Brennan, who, when he's not filling his priestly functions, is Professor of Law at Australian Catholic University. We have much to cover tonight with Frank. First of all, Frank, it's lovely to see you. It's been a while.
It's great to be back, Philip. I've come from the snowiest winter in Boston, the coldest February ever. And I have to say, to give a plug to your show, I enjoyed listening to your podcast over there, if only to listen to Bruce Shapiro to interpret to me the strange society in which I was living for 10 months. So, thank you.
I must ask you, did you call in to see our mutual friend, Mr. Rudd, because you and I are the only people in this country who profess to still liking him?
And I do have to confess, I saw quite a bit of him in Boston, and it was a pleasure to do so. In fact, I'll let his critics know that I had the privilege of attending a public lecture he gave in Harvard on China-US relations, and he graciously invited me back to the Harvard Club after it with the world's leading China scholars, where he more than held his own. So there you go.
Well, I wonder how you're going to hold your own, because we've got a pretty heavy agenda
here. Sure, serve it up.
So, and much of it, some of it is pleasant, some of it is, to say the least, challenging. Now, Tony Abbott isn't the only one receiving some blessings from the polls this week. A survey on Monday suggests that an overwhelming majority of our fellow citizens, 75% to be precise, would vote yes on constitutional recognition of Indigenous Australians. Now, I can see you beaming almost with pleasure because you've been campaigning for this for a good part of your life, haven't you?
I have, and I've just done a book on it, which came out this week. And what I have done in that book, Philip, is try and look at some of the lessons from the 1967 referendum. And basically, my political conclusion is that nothing works as well as a modest referendum proposal carried overwhelmingly by the Australian public, but which then provides the political imperative for change.
You will be astonished that I actually have a copy of this book.
I'm delighted to learn.
I'm going to hold it up to the microphone.
Hold it up for the listeners.
I shall. Now, you were famously described by Paul Keating as the meddling priest.
Indeed.
And that was, in a sense, over Indigenous
tent
issues.
It was over the Wick debate, yeah.
Remind us, why did Paul find you so, shall we say, problematic?
Do you want the long version or the short version?
Please, the short.
Basically, after the Wick decision, when the Howard government had been elected, they were going to trample upon the Keating Native Title Act, on which, as you will recall and listeners will know, I mean, Keating invested a lot of political sweat and a lot of political capital in getting his Native Title Act up in 1993. But then came the Wick decision in 1996, and you had a freshly mandated Howard government that said they wanted to wind back native title anyway. Well, the political cocktail was made very difficult because the balance of power was held in the Senate by Brian Harradine. And Brian Harradine...
Another one of you Catholics.
Indeed, and some saw some great Catholic conspiracy. I don't think I've made public before that one of the things was during the final stages of the lead-up to the third Senate debate on all of this, I was actually in Taiwan at a human rights conference with Les Meltzer, of all people, now the head of the National Congress of Indigenous Peoples. I then got to Hong Kong and I got a phone call from, of all people, Tony Abbott, who was, I think, the Minister for Health at the time, saying, Frank, we need you back.
He's a Catholic.
He's a Catholic. And he said, we need you back here in Australia, mate, to help you know, get this legislation through. Well, I had the good fortune to have heard that Andrew Peacock at the time was the ambassador in the United States. And Peacock had had a boozy lunch with someone and said the trouble was that Brennan was unreliable and couldn't deliver Haradine. So I said to Abbott, look, I'll be back in a couple of weeks' time and have a good time. Well, by the time I got back, the deal had been cut, but I endorsed it on the basis that I thought Haradine had delivered more than he promised to deliver to the Indigenous leadership. Well, for Paul, that was too much, and I understand that, but I think history does show that Haradine did a pretty good job in pretty difficult circumstances.
Ever been reconciled with Keating?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah. And, I think he's one of the greats. I'd have to say, though, when it comes to constitutional change, the style of leadership which is necessary in Australia is different from the Keating style, because you've got to bring with you the whole of the Australian community, and that's very difficult
work. And there are great problems ahead. Mm. Okay. I'm struck by how outdated some parts of our constitution are, and you emphasise this in your tome, when it comes to the notion of race. Can you explain Section 25 and Section 5126,
sure,
please?
And I'll try and do it for a non-legal audience, Philip. Section 25 is actually, it's what I call the piece of low-hanging fruit in getting rid of the notion of race. We Australians have developed the idea that it's a racist provision. It's actually derivative from one of the post-Civil War provisions in the United States Constitution. And if anything, its intention was benign. What it basically does is to say that if any of the states were to discriminate against people on the basis of race when it came to elections in state elections, then there would be a lesser number of seats available in the House of Representatives. So, strangely, it was creating an incentive for the states not to be racist in the election process in the state parliaments so that they could have maximum representation in the House of Representatives. But suffice to say, Section 25 has never been used. It's now a dead letter. It's outdated. Everyone agrees that it's a piece of low-hanging fruit. It's got to go.
So you're calling for it to be deleted and for Section 5126 to be reformed.
Well, 5126 is a different and more problematic area, Philip. 5126, prior to the 1967 referendum, basically said the Commonwealth Parliament had power to make laws with respect to people other than of the Aboriginal race. Now, that gives the clue that prior to 1967, obviously, 5126 was a provision which would allow the Commonwealth Parliament to make laws adverse to people of a particular race. For example, the Chinese who ran laundries or were conducting the gold mines at the time of Federation, or where the West Australians wanted to keep out people of a particular race, that sort of thing. But with the 67 referendum, and this is one of the cautions I note 50 years on, it was none other than the great constitutional luminary Prime Minister Robert Menzies who warned at the time that if you took out the exception relating to Aborigines, then you were giving the Commonwealth Parliament to make laws which could be adverse to the interests of Aborigines. Now, at the time of the 67 referendum, most people said, look, let's not worry about that. It would only be exercised benignly. Well, Menzies was right. And so years later, when you had things like the federal intervention, or you'll remember the dispute over the Hindmarsh Island Bridge and things of that sort, Aboriginal people said, well, hang on, 5126 is being used by the Commonwealth Parliament to make laws that we think are adverse to our interests. Now, what I'm suggesting is that instead of a provision which is based on race, which the expert panel led by luminaries like Pat Dodson and Mark Liebler, they rightly said, look, the notion of race is outdated and it shouldn't appear in the Constitution. So instead of having a power to make laws with respect to the people of a particular race, I asked the question, well, why not have the power to make laws with respect to particular aspects of Aboriginal life? And that then leads to the major suggestion that I'd have, namely that I think it is time in our constitution to have an acknowledgement of the key facts, namely that Aborigines were the first occupiers and things of that sort.
Okay, I want to get into the phrasing a little later, but you will make the point that in the absence of a Bill of Rights, why would we contemplate a comprehensive constitutional ban on racial discrimination, but not a ban on sexual discrimination or discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or religious belief?
Well, you'll understand, Philip, that I, having chaired for the Rudd government, the National Human Rights Consultation, I learned some pretty bitter lessons about both sides of politics and their appetite for human rights being recognised even in overriding legislation, let alone in a constitution. So we're dealing with politicians who are pretty agnostic about the need to go down the American or the Canadian path in terms of judicialising these sorts of questions.
And it's by no means a simple Labour-Liberal argument.
Oh, it's not at all.
You get someone like Bob Carr, who is apoplectic at any suggestion of a Bill of Rights, despite his love of the American
law. Indeed. In fact, I think during that debate, Bob regarded me as something of a heretic.
Oh, heaven forbid. Now, I also had to go back a little. You're also making it clear, well, you're pointing, I don't know if you made it clear because it's pretty hard, that there's a lot of white Australian anxieties mixed up
in our
attitude to the Indigenous people.
And the argument I put, Philip, is if you look back at the lessons of 1967, I think the art of statesmanship, if I may use that term, of constitutional change, is that you've got to hold in balance Indigenous aspirations, constitutional architecture, and popular sentiment. So, first of all, you've got to have a sense of course, you're not going to get unanimity amongst the Indigenous leadership, but there will be some coherence of views amongst the majority of respected Aboriginal leaders, so you're attentive to that. But then you've got to ensure that whatever you're proposing to put in the Constitution doesn't do violence to the architecture of the whole document and is legally coherent. And then you've got to make sure it's something which is saleable to the Australian community generally.
Some years ago, on the occasion of a significant anniversary of the famous and successful referendum, Faith Bandler came in, and I said to her, "Do you think it'd pass as spectacularly now?" And she thought about it and sadly opined that she didn't think it would. She felt that, and I said, "Is that because racism has got worse in Australia?" She said, "No, but it has got better organised."
Yes.
Now, I raise this because, of course, one can hear, unless this is handled and managed brilliantly, a cacophony of ultra-conservative critics, many of whom have shock jock microphones available to them. Who are the other enemies?
Well, I think the other enemies are those who say that, look, get rid of the notion of race out of the Constitution. Why shouldn't we simply be silent about all particular groups in society and just have a document which is, if you like, colourblind and which basically is assimilationist?
Well, that's
and
the
is
Gary Johns argument that I
absolutely
read today.
Yeah. And so one response to that, and in fact, it's a response I thought of coming in on the train tonight to talk to you, Philip. I thought it would have particular appeal to you. That is that the preamble of the Australian Constitution does mention God. Now, not all Australians believe that God exists, whereas I think all Australians, including Gary Johns and Andrew Bolt, would concede that the Aborigines were the first occupiers of the land. So why not mention what are indisputable facts? And I think if we can do that, the real challenge then for the Indigenous leaders, as I've said to a few of them, is this. Do you go for a modest change at this stage where you get rid of the terra nullius assimilationist mindset of the Constitution, where you actually get mentioned, but noting that it's a fairly minimalist sort of change in the hope that in the future you get something more? Or do you simply go for no change at all at the moment in the hope that it creates a greater political imperative for bigger change in the future?
One of the best jobs I had was chairing the National Australia Day Council. And in the run-up to the Centenary of Federation, which we thought was also going to involve reconciliation and a republic, we started commissioning preambles. There's a lot of them going around at the time. Les Murray, I think, had a crack at one.
Yes, he did.
And we got some marvellous preambles written, quite inspirational, because I have to suggest that the prose in our Constitution is a bit stodgy. It doesn't have the vaulting rhetoric that you get in a really well-written one. What do you think about a preamble?
Well, I think they're coming back to the question of constitutional architecture. What we have at the moment is an imperial act, which is the Constitution Act, which does contain a preamble, which mentions things like God. And then as an appendix to that imperial act, there is the Australian Constitution, which contains no preamble at all. Now, my problem with a preamble which is focused primarily on Indigenous matters is this. The idea of a preamble in a legal document is to set out the reasons why we are legislating or why we're constituting. Now, if we were setting out a preamble about Australia, we would say we were constituting the Federation for reasons not just related to Indigenous Australians. And so it would have to be more comprehensive, as some of those preambles have been. But at the moment, I don't think there's an appetite in the Australian community for looking at anything much beyond the Indigenous issue. And that's why I say, instead of a preamble at the beginning of the Constitution, why not have an acknowledgement? And an acknowledgement in terms of the words which were put forward by the expert panel and of which have been unanimously adopted by the Australian Parliament already in an act of recognition.
You mentioned in passing the term colourblind, and that was a piece of strategy that came out of right-wing politics, yes, in the United States not so long ago. And it sounds terrific, but of course it's very dangerous. But let me put to you a question that Johns and others constantly raise. Constitutional change can have no practical impact upon the welfare of Indigenous Australians. Do you think it could?
I think it could, but I mean, I concede something in their argument, but where I think it's faulty is that it's basically putting an either-or proposition. And as I say, constitutional change, it's not, well, we have constitutional change or practical change. I say it's both and. We do them together. And you'll have noted from the book that a lot of what I draw on from post-67 are the wonderful writings of Stanner, the great anthropologist who was on that Council for Aboriginal Affairs. Now, he long had that image of Aboriginal people who moved between what he called the dreaming and the market. And as I say, in contemporary Australia, there are no Aboriginal Australians who are happier than those who have a secure foothold both in the dreaming and in the market. But those who have the most wretched of lives are those who have a foothold in neither. Now, I dedicated the book to one of the young Aboriginal men up in Daly River, a community I know pretty well, who did take his own life 5 years ago. And it was my privilege on returning from the US to go to Daly River and present the book there to the family and to the community. Now, what I sense in those sorts of communities is, look, we know there's no magic in some white fella constitutional document, but we do want to have a greater sense of being recognised, and we want to have a greater sense of being at the table as white fellas come to look at the huge problems we have on these remote communities.
Sitting opposite me is my favourite Jesuit, Paul Keating's meddling priest, Frank Brennan, and we're discussing at this stage No Small Change, The Road to Recognition for Indigenous Australians. A lot more territory to cover, so let me put this to you. People of goodwill who want to do the right thing constitutionally are somewhat confused at the moment because there is by no means a new unanimity of view amongst the Aboriginal leadership.
And I'm one of those people of goodwill, and I say to the Indigenous leaders, we are waiting to hear which way you want to go with the fork in the road. And the fork in the road, I think, is pretty simple. One fork in the road is a very short road, and it's the road to 2017, which would be a road of acknowledgement and empowerment of the Commonwealth Parliament to make laws with respect to the facts that we acknowledge about Aboriginal culture, land, heritage, traditions. The other fork in the road is a much longer road. It's got a very uncertain destination, and it may be that Indigenous leaders say to us, we're not interested in taking that short fork, we want to wait for the long fork, in which case I say, fine, we've all got busy lives to lead, we'll go away and do something else. But if you want to know what I would think, I think if I were an Indigenous leader, I'd say, I'd want to take the short fork now, in the hope that it provides a better launching pad for the long fork in the future.
So one of the things we have to do, and this is not going to air, no one can hear this part of the conversation.
Yes. This will be under the seal of the confession.
We've got to, in a sense, wedge the Andrew bolts, don't we? We've got to find a way of making it impossible for them to be divisive and unpleasant.
Well, I think that can be done by saying, well, look, here are the things that we want acknowledged in the Constitution. Is there anything there which you would not acknowledge yourself? And if you would happily acknowledge those things, wouldn't you see it as constitutive of the nation that we acknowledge these things about Indigenous Australia? And if so, wouldn't you see it as essential that the National Parliament have power to make laws with respect to those things? Whether that works as a wedge or just as a persuasion, I don't know.
Let's move on now to the question of the death penalty, which is
a happier topic, Philip.
Yeah, laugh a minute. We did a program a week or so ago on the Boston bomber trial.
Yes.
A fascinating study of the bloke Yoko Tsarnaev, who was just sentenced to death. Yes, he's a criminal. Yes, his actions claimed the lives of three, including an eight-year-old boy. And yes, many, many people were very seriously injured. But I think you and I share the same view, you as a member of the Catholic Church and me as an atheist, that we oppose the death penalty in all circumstances.
Indeed, yes. And, I mean, living in Boston during that trial, it just came home to me so strongly as to how perverse and macabre the death penalty has now become, not just in countries like Indonesia, but in the United States. I mean, there in Massachusetts, you've got to remember, Massachusetts has abolished the death penalty. Most criminal offences are state offences. The latest opinion polls show that 15% only of Bostonians favoured the death penalty in this case, which was a case of a federal offence. They had to spend weeks trying to find a jury of 12 members who were said to be death ready to hear this trial. Now, just imagine, you're living in a jurisdiction which has abolished the death penalty. 85% of your community members are opposed to the death penalty, even in a case of this sort. So they have to find a jury that says it's death ready. How in God's name?
What an appalling expression.
How can you say that is a trial by 12 of your peers? It is a trial by a perverted sample of your peers, namely those who are prepared to impose the death penalty when most of the community think there is no place for it.
You make the point that the death penalty is always political, and I can't think of a case where it isn't.
Look at what's gone on there in the United States in Alabama. In Alabama, the state judges are elected. And Justice Sotomayor, who's a very gutsy performer on the US Supreme Court on these issues, I mean, she's the modern equivalent of someone like your Brennan or your Thurgood Marshall. She's there as a strong opponent of the death penalty. She has pointed out, she's done the statistics. Do you know that in Alabama, state judges are 10 times more likely to override a jury decision for life imprisonment and impose the death penalty than they are to override a death penalty decision and give life imprisonment?
But this is because it improves their chances of re-election.
Exactly.
But the notion of electing judges, it sounds wonderfully democratic.
Well,
the effect of it is
perverse,
monstrous, isn't it?
And then you look at, you know, the Supreme Court there 2 weeks ago hearing the case about the three drugs that are used as the protocol for administering capital punishment in places like Oklahoma.
Yes, let's deal with this, the horror stories, because...
I mean, the transcript is just so macabre, Philip. I mean, you read the transcript of this most exalted High Court of the United States of America. You have Justice Alito seriously asking counsel, if we could effectively anaesthetize an individual, would it still be cruel and unusual punishment to burn them at the stake? This is not 1715. This is in the year 2015. You've got the Chief Justice Roberts saying, oh, maybe a gas chamber or a firing squad is more humane. You've got Scalia sitting there saying, how dare you come here on a political campaign questioning the efficacy of this anaesthetic drug because this is just part of a campaign by the abolitionists who have scared the European drug companies not being prepared to make the proper anaesthetics available. So, of course, this is an effective drug for anaesthetics. Well, I would have thought that's just a medical pharmaceutical question. It has nothing to do with the political campaigning of those who are, to quote Justice Alito, conducting guerrilla warfare in relation to getting rid of the death penalty. It is a truly macabre issue.
And, of course, we've still got a competition amongst those of the George W. Bush persuasion to keep the death chambers humming.
Yes, yeah.
Because it's politically advantageous in some parts of America to so do.
Mm. And it will remain that sort of political issue.
I wonder how many of the candidates who are climbing onto the Republican bus at the moment would have a word against the death penalty. Mm.
I can't think of any at the moment.
Okay.
Maybe Bruce Shapiro will find one for us.
We'll ask Bruce. Just tell me, or tell the listener, about one execution which I recall being so botched that the prisoner was left writhing for 2 hours.
Yes. That was a prisoner by the name of Wood. And, yes, they botched the injections, and so he was left writhing and was coming in and out of consciousness as they were getting ready, because the protocol requires first an anaesthetic, then something which paralyses the person, and then something to arrest the heart. Well, with the anaesthesia not working effectively, the poor fellow was left there basically writhing on the table in the presence of all the state officials.
I remember Jeffrey Robinson sitting where you were. He came back from one of his trips to America absolutely convinced, and this is 10 or 15 years ago, that the death penalty was over. And his argument was that the Supreme Court would recognise that waiting for the death penalty, waiting on death row for often 10, 15, 20 years, was in and of itself cruel and unusual punishment. And that seemed to me to be absolutely applicable in the case of Andrew Chan and Sukumaran.
Yeah, but one of the points I want to make on all of this, Philip, is I think a lot of Australians have taken, you know, a pretty dim view of the Indonesian legal system. Now, I think there is a hell of a lot wrong with the Indonesian legal system, but drawing the parallel between Chan and Sukumaran and the way they were treated and the treatment of the Boston bomber, I make the point, it doesn't matter how perfected your legal system is, it still remains a very political and macabre decision. I was in one class there at the Boston College Law School, where I've just had the year, and we were discussing the death penalty, and one student, obviously a very strong Republican, he put the argument to me. He said, the benefit of the death penalty, you have to understand, is because it's a life and death issue, this forces everyone, including the attorneys and the judges, to focus their mind on very high matters of legal principle and not to let anything else interfere with it. Well,
that's
the results are just twaddle.
That's twaddle. Okay, now, of course, our government and the Catholic Church protested what happened in Indonesia, and there was a renewed push to advocate against the death penalty pretty much around the world. But we seem to be showing silence towards the case in Boston. Official silence.
Well, I think that's part of the Australian mentality, which is that, I mean, to put it very bluntly, I think it's we think, oh, well, you know, the Indonesian legal system is a bit of a rum show, but, you know, how dare we criticise the American legal system?
There's a form of the cultural cringe, if you like.
I think so, yeah.
And more than a hint of racism. Okay, now, the US, I've got to ask you this, when did the Catholic Church make up its mind on capital punishment, indeed it has?
Well, there's still a bit of ambivalence there, Philip. The Pope John Paul II, when he was Pope, he came up with the idea that the solution to a lot of the problems in the postmodernist world would be to reinvent the notion of a catechism, which would set out the definitive Catholic answers on all sorts of questions. Now, I'm not a great fan of catechisms, I have to say. I think life's a bit more complex than just being definitive about everything that you think might be there in the grocery list. But when he brought out his first edition...
I don't talk about the catechism as a grocery list. I've got to cover your back, Frank.
Please, thank you, Philip.
Terrible trouble.
But anyway, the first edition of his catechism that came out basically acknowledged that there was still a place for the death penalty, and very conservative Catholics, particularly in the United States, continued to argue that there was a place for it. But then when a revision of the catechism was done, Pope John Paul II himself basically put the argument to say that there are practically no circumstances in which it could be justified. So he didn't go to the extent which we do in Catholic moral theology of saying that it would always be intrinsically evil, like contraception, for example, Philip, but we won't discuss that this evening. And but to say
who
that...
Who says we won't? That's my next question.
Of course.
Your constant attacks on the French letter. Okay.
But that... practically, you could not imagine a case where you would be justified in using capital punishment. The only conceivable case would be where the state had no way of guaranteeing that a person could be held confined so that they wouldn't commit another capital offence. Other than that, the traditional Catholic position now is that capital punishment ain't on. And in Massachusetts, the Catholic bishops all together came out opposed to the death penalty in this case.
Okay. I want to go back one step. The next case of an Australian on death row abroad mightn't be too far away. Two of our citizens in China are facing capital punishment. How difficult is it going to be for us to advocate for their clemency if we don't show consistency towards this case in the US?
Well, I think it's very difficult indeed. And I think this was part of the situation that we confronted when we came to the Indonesians with Chan and Sukumaran. I mean, at the time that the Indonesians were dealing with the Bali bombers, I think some of our politicians were not sufficiently consistent. And I have to include in that our dear mutual friend. And what we have is a situation where often it can be easy for populist purposes in the heat of the moment to say that, oh, well, maybe it's justified or permissible in this particular case. I think the only way we as Australians are going to get anywhere in developing the argument internationally is by being thoroughly logically consistent.
And, of course, I expect this from the Catholic Church quite seriously, because here is a faith based on a case of capital punishment.
Indeed.
Now, I want to move on in a minute to sexual abuse questions, which have arisen this very day as we sit and chat.
But it doesn't make this a unique day.
No. But before we do that, Frank... the current Pope, are you pleased with his performance?
I am. And it's not just because he's a Jesuit, it's not just because his name is Frank, or the name that he chose. But I went down to Argentina over Christmas, to Buenos Aires, and retraced some of his steps, and I must say, I like the cut of his jib, and I think he's doing great pastoral work. I think the thing about him that appeals to me is that there's no intellectual pretension to him. He knows that someone like Benedict, whatever criticisms we might make of Ratzinger, I mean, the man was a true European intellectual and a first-rate theologian. This guy's come along and basically said, look, after the papacies of John Paul II and Benedict, we've all had enough. Some of us are gutful, but others of us at least an intellectual sufficiency of the dogma and the pedagogy. Basically, this guy's come along and said, we're called to be pastors. We're called to engage in the pastoral exercise of preaching the good news, which is available not just to those who profess all of the dogmas set down by the Catholic Church. And this guy, it's in his skin, he's comfortable with it, and he's out there doing it. And I think that's great news.
Does he have a good food taster?
Well, in fact, the day he was elected, Paul Bongiorno sent me a text message saying exactly that. And the evidence to date would seem to be that he has.
But
I mean, the cynics
enemies
about the Vatican say, of course, that's why he moved out of the papal apartments, not as a witness to poverty, but if he was there at St. Martha's, that he'd be eating the same food as others, and it'd be unlikely they'd knock them all off. Now, I'm not so cynical about the Vatican, but I do think that he's in a situation where he's living cheek by jowl with people. He's happy to get out there and do things. I know, for example, at the Jesuit Curia there, the Jesuit headquarters, I think it was last year, the Feast of St. Ignatius, July 31, without any fanfare, he turns up in his Ford Focus and walks in for lunch. There was a photo then shown of all the Jesuits gathered with him. Well, God help us, I think of the 60 or so there, there were only two or three in clerical collars. The rest were just standing around like you and me.
I warmed to him. I haven't felt so warm towards a pope since John 23.
Exactly.
And, there
and for
is,
the same reasons.
And there is a sense of quiet euphoria about what's going on, but it's balanced by a fear for him.
Yes.
Not, when, you know, I'm not literally talking murder, but a fear that the enemies are very powerful, they're everywhere. And you can see the stridency of the critique, particularly coming out of the right wing in the US.
It's quite strong, yeah. But
because they seem as commo, don't they?
Well, I mean, what's been delightful
Jesus
to
is
see
a commo, we
is,
know that.
I mean, some of the American right wing who in the past, whenever a papal encyclical so-called was coming out, they'd be there strongly defending the papacy. Well, they're terrified about what this fellow's going to say in his forthcoming encyclical on the environment. So they're already publishing the intellectual qualifications you put on encyclicals. Well, it's welcome to hear that from the right wing, but basically I think this guy is happy to mix it on the really big questions and to do it in a pastoral way.
Well, if he comes out as energetically on the issue of climate change as one anticipates, it does change the politics of the issue around the planet.
It does, and the thing is, you've got to understand, this is a guy who comes from the South. And, you know, it's no longer Europe, it's no longer the United States. This is a guy who comes from the South, he identifies with the poor, and his question is, how is harm to the environment affecting those who are the poorest in our societies?
One of the other things I like about him is he takes the accelerator of matters of sexuality.
Oh, yes.
And he helps everyone calm down a little because, as you and I have said off mic on a number of occasions, the lack of a sexual maturation process to go through the church is one of the great driving forces for the problems of sexual abuse.
Look, a church headed by a male celibate clergy should be the last one to be out there sprouting stuff about sexuality. And I've always had a standard rule myself, saying to myself, well, what are the married Anglicans and Uniting Church people saying about it? And yes, do I agree with that? Fine. But beyond that, then I'm very cautious.
This is the voice of Frank Brennan. His new book is called No Small Change, The Road to Recognition for Indigenous Australia. But we are moving on to a wide variety of other topics, and the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse has heard quite alarming testimonies, and one gets used to alarming testimonies, regarding a paedophile ring operating in and around the Victorian town of Ballarat, the most beautiful town, which I've always adored, throughout the 1970s. One priest, Gerald Risdale, abused every boy at a school between the ages of 10 and 16. Now, as a priest, how do you maintain your faith in the direction of the Catholic Church, given its betrayal in these cases of such vulnerable people? This must have been as big a test of your faith as anything.
It's tough. It's bloody tough, I have to say. And, you know, I see it in friends. I see it in, you know, close confidants of mine for whom just this betrayal of trust by the church is just the last straw. And for me, it's been very demanding, but I've long taken the consolation that one of the things is that we live in societies where we have what Rowan Williams once called multiple affiliations. And how good it is, I mean, how dreadful it would be, for example, to live in a theocratic state. And how dreadful it would be to live in a situation where the only expression of Christianity was that of the Roman Catholic Church. Now, I know some will think that's heresy coming from a Catholic priest, but the plurality, I think, is essential. And part of the challenge for me has been that prior to the calling of this Royal Commission, I knew that we had problems looking at the statistics compared with the Anglicans and the Uniting Church. But I had consoled myself with the thought that, well, we ran more schools, we ran more welfare services, all that sort of thing. But it would seem that it's far more ingrained in that. Now, I don't know that the celibacy issue and that sort of thing accounts so much for the abuse, but I do think the clericalism of the show helps to account for the cover-ups that were there for so long, or the inability to detect.
When you say clerical, you mean, in a sense, the bureaucratic nature of the church.
Yes, yeah. The bureaucratic and the hierarchical nature of the church. And I know, even for myself, Philip, there would be some of my fellow Jesuits who from time to time have even respectfully intimated that, well, you know, should you be making criticisms of particular bishops? You know, our job is there to support the institution. Well, that's no longer a tenable proposition. To support the institution in the long term, there's got to be honest critique of individuals who have failed. And as I say, I mean, all that's being espoused by the Australian community, God help us, is they want transparency, they want compassion, and they want justice. Well, there's nothing in any of those notions which is inconsistent with the gospel. And in fact, things to the contrary that have been done to the church are just irreproachably distant from gospel values.
I'm now going to be heretical in terms of many of the listeners who will hate me saying this. You and I once were in the same church at the funeral someone we both held in high regard and with great affection, who was accused of paedophilia. Mm. The case never got to court because he elected to kill himself. Mm. But we were there, not in any way to approve of his activities, but in a sense, our compassion reached out to him. Mm. And I have some compassion for priests who have failed. Because I accept the arguments of Gary Wills, that wonderful American Catholic intellectual, that it's been very hard for a young priest to deal with his own sexuality, to deal with, well, as I said before, the lack of permission to sexually mature.
Yes.
And just as Amnesty, I was thrilled when I joined Amnesty, and one of the reasons was someone in Amnesty said, our compassion goes to the torturer as well as the tortured. And I found there was good reason to know that, because I actually met torturers and heard their stories and how they were manipulated, bullied into being monsters. Mm. Now, it's not your business to point fingers at individuals, but we have to raise the fact that George Pell may be in a bit of trouble here, because he may have known about Risdale's crimes against children years before he faced charges and may have been involved in decisions to move him around. He's always said he didn't. Mm. If the evidence keeps running this way, would you support a very stern attitude towards Pell?
Oh, sure. Look, it doesn't matter who the individual is. I mean, I think we've got to distinguish. I mean, compassion, I take your point. And I think often in the past, part of what confronted bishops was being compassionate towards an erring priest for whom this was not only their life, it was their work, it was their everything. But the distinction had to be drawn between being compassionate to the individual and saying, well, we're also got to be compassionate and just towards the children.
And that was singularly lacking in many cases, not only within the Catholic Church.
Not only in the Catholic Church, and there were institutional problems at large. You will remember that one of the first cases that came to light was the investigation that the Church asked Tony Whitlam to do into an historic case up in Armidale. And there'd been a bishop, long since deceased, Bishop Kennedy, who had suspended a priest who'd been found out for dreadful crimes against a child. And it was the psychologist at the time who kept writing to Kennedy saying, look, for God's sake, give this guy a second chance. I think he's reformed himself. And Kennedy ultimately relented and let him back into the job. Now, sure, that would never happen nowadays, but that back then...
You mean
I
it
think
would never happen here, or would never happen anywhere?
Well, it would never happen here. I'm sure there are some countries in which it would happen, but there's the compassion issue, but then there's the justice question. And then, you know, you've raised the particular question about Pell and Ballarat or whatever. I say, look, the evidence has to fall where it is. Now, I've been a strong defender of Pell when, for example, I thought the Fairfax Press was very unfair on him at one stage during the Royal Commission, and I did defend him. But equally, when the Royal Commission came out and made findings against the Archdiocese of Sydney and Pell as its leader over the Ellis case, equally I've been critical of him. And so I would simply say the evidence has to fall where it is. Let's wait to hear the findings from the Royal Commission. But if they're adverse to Pell, then I have no hesitation in saying, of course he has to go.
Tell us about the what has become known as the Ellis Defence.
Well, the Ellis Defence was premised on the notion that the Catholic Church was not an incorporated body and that the assets of the church were vested in a trust, and the trust was separate and apart from the group who administered the church, including the clergy. And so
That's as tricky as the most advanced theological argument.
It is. It's like the theology of the Trinity.
Yes.
And so it was a defence which was used by some church leaders, and ultimately it came to be accepted that, of course, any sort of false notions of the corporate veil had to go, and that you had to ensure that a body was available that could be sued, or you had to undertake that if sued, you would honour the judgment debt. Now, there are still complex legal questions that are unresolved. One of my differences with Justice McClellan of the Royal Commission is that I thought early in his inquiry he was intimating that he somehow would be able to change the law of vicarious liability. Now, that's a very complex area of law which has been developed by the High Court over generations. Ultimately, the law of vicarious liability can only be changed by the courts, not by a Royal Commission. So we've got those things, but the Ellis defence comes back to the notion that it is completely unwarranted for a church or any social institution to hide behind the corporate veil.
It's become as unacceptable as the Nuremberg defence, hasn't
Indeed.
It, in that way. Mm. In your life, was it ever an issue with you? Were you ever molested as a
No. Yes?
Never.
No, in fact, and, you know, I was in an all-male country boarding school in Toowoomba where there were 400 of us in dormitories, and I not only did I never experience anything myself, to this day I am not aware of any of my fellow students who have made any allegations against any of the priests who taught us. So maybe I was very lucky, very blessed. One of the difficulties for me on all of this, Philip, has been it's not as if I'm a shrinking violet and it's not as if I don't have a public profile, but I'm prepared to swear on the Bible that I have only ever had one victim of abuse come to me to tell me his story directly in order to seek something to be done by the church authorities.
Have you ever been approached by an abuser?
Well, if I have, I don't know that she was an abuser.
To come to you to ask for help in his or her struggle.
No, I haven't. No.
Mm. Okay. But it may be. I mean, the church is not purged of this yet. I'm wondering what impact it's having on recruiting.
It's having a dreadful impact. And it's having a dreadful impact on the morale of those of us who are left behind. And basically, it is a very purgative experience for the whole institution, and it's a very purgative experience for those of us who try and do a day's work.
I love the word purgative because, of course, it refers to a religious concept which is no longer operational.
Indeed.
You've sacked purgatory, haven't you?
We have, but that which is purgative is still in some circumstances seen to be a good thing. Yeah. And, you know, this is a crucifixion for a lot of us, but it's going to be a very good thing to come through it. I must say, I, from Boston, watched some of the hearing up there in Rockhampton, and there was a woman who had been a nun, I think her name was Rowan, but she'd left the convent, but she had been the boss of the Sisters of Mercy, and her evidence, I mean, I just felt so proud to be Christian and Catholic when I heard her speak, because there she was. She had established relationships with all of these victims. She praised them for their courage, and she was there incarnating what is the very best about the values we espouse.
As you know, I often say that the only lefties left in Australia are the Jesuit intellectuals and nuns.
and because nuns on the bus, as they say in the US.
Because on almost every issue of progressive politics, there they are, particularly the nuns. But, God, they've been having a rough time in the United States,
they
which
have,
raises the whole question.
Yeah, but Francis, you'll see, has he basically closed down that inquisition on them, and it was all but an apology. And, you know, call them to Rome and sat down and they had afternoon tea together and they're all palsy again.
What's your attitude to these fundamental, well, currently absolutely basic teachings of the Church on, for example, the notion of female priests?
Well, I've long been a supporter of female priests, and I think that it's got to be acknowledged that the Vatican in its wisdom years ago set up a theological and biblical commission to look into the question, and they were of the view that there was no warrant against it. Now, what we have at the moment is still a papal teaching on it, which Francis has consolidated in saying the question's not up for discussion.
That'd be just a bridge too far for him at the moment.
It would be for him at the moment, and I mean, though I'm a great fan of his, I think, and I see this in the United States a lot, and I hear it from a lot of the women in the United States and also here in Australia, I mean, he doesn't quite get women in the social institution of the Church. There is a slightly, you know, Latin patronising air to him on that. You might remember a while ago he said, well, you know, it's good we've now got some women on the Theological Commission. Well, good on him for doing that. But he said, well, they're like the strawberries on the cake. Well,
He did.
And that shows that there's still work to be done.
Yes.
And, you know, basically back on the abuse thing, I can't help thinking, you know, given the many mothers I know around the place, if only there'd been a few women in control of the show or there at the table from the very beginning, we wouldn't have seen the sorts of cover-ups that have gone on over generations. Would have been very different.
Okay, it's not my purpose of having you here tonight to sort of just to be abusive towards the Church.
Not at all.
One of the things, as you know, I happen to hold another group in the highest regard, and that's the LCs, the lapsed Catholics, because even those who've walked away from the Church because of this or that dogma take with them the fundamental values of Catholicism.
Particularly social justice.
Social justice. And I can remember one night I had three extraordinary women on, one from the United States, one from the UK, one from Australia. Each of them were dissidents and terribly influential ones in their own political system. And I wondered what the hell they had in common. So I asked a question without knowing the answer, and guess what? The three of them, a black senator in the United States, a woman who'd walked out of the the Blair government over a certain war, and an Australian woman who'd been a premier, all of them had been Catholics. People like this are always Catholics, aren't they, even though they're notionally lapsed?
They are, and it is one of the things that I worry about in our society, Australia, that, I mean, with the diminution of the Catholic Church, where are we going to get in future generations the people who have got that selflessness, but at the same time the self-composition, which is born of a robust dogma, a good pedagogy, and a really grounded pastoral sense.
But you don't doubt for a minute that there are a great number of people who tick most of those boxes who are atheists, agnostics.
Oh, absolutely.
Members of other religions.
This Sunday, I'll celebrate Mass and preach there at Redfern for the 10th anniversary of the death of the great Ted Kennedy, who was the priest there at Redfern. Now, I have no doubt in that church there will be Catholics of all persuasions and none, but we will come to the table and we will share the bread and the wine and we will celebrate. And that's what it's about.
That's what it's all about. Father Frank, Jesuit for our age. And that's it for now. That's it from me. Next week, you'll hear from my colleague Andrew West, who's bringing you a week of the highlights from his time in the chair earlier this year. NNL Summer on RN. Stick around now for the news.